We are diving deep into the strategic movements shaping M&A right now, drawing exclusively from the most relevant posts on LinkedIn during calendar weeks 43 and 44. This comprehensive analysis is provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenis, a B2B market research firm specializing in supporting M&A consultancies with critical market and competition perspective for things like commercial due diligences. Welcome to the deep dive. Our mission today is pretty simple. Cut through all the noise online, and really deliver the strategic nuggets that genuinely shifted deal execution these past few weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
We're looking at where the money's going, what deal structures are actually working, and maybe why so many deals seem to run into trouble after closing.
That's the plan. And rather than just like a dry list of facts, we've clustered the key insights. Makes it easier to digest, I think.
Good idea.
So first, we'll hit market activity, where our deal makers putting their chips.
Yeah.
And second, got to talk about valuation, that persistent gap, and some really creative structuring we saw.
Always a hot topic.
Always. And finally, the crucial non-financial stuff. Strategy, people, process readiness. You know, the things that really decide if a deal succeeds or fails.
Okay, let's jump right into theme one then, market activity. If you want to see where things are headed, you watch the big deals, right? What were the standout strategic moves these weeks? Anything signal a real shift?
Well, the Knight acquisition of Experiential Supply, that definitely turned heads.
Right.
Chris Irwin pointed out the strategic thinking behind it. Knight, they manage these huge digital creators, right? Your Mr. Beast types.
Right.
Experts in viral content.
Okay. And Experiential Supply.
They're all about live event production. So putting those two together.
Ah, okay. Digital reach meets physical experience. Why is that so powerful now?
Because audiences are kind of saturated online. They're craving real world, offline engagement.
Makes sense.
So this merger, it creates this full stack thing, takes Knight's digital mastery and plugs it straight into physical events. They're targeting that massive, like $100 billion plus creator and events market, recognizing that the next big thing is turning digital fans into, well, actual attendees.
Yeah.
It's a really smart synergy play.
Yeah, that leap from online buzz to actually getting people to show up, I see it. We also saw some big moves just for scale, didn't we? Particularly in professional service.
Oh, absolutely. The RSM UK and RSM US LLP merger, that's pushing them towards, what, $5 billion combined revenue?
Huge number.
Yeah. And James Gosling noted, it really highlights the power of the partnership model for scaling globally in that sector. Accountancy, consulting, it's a way to get massive growth without, say, bringing in private equity.
Interesting contrast. Now, zooming out a bit, the global outlook seems, well, mixed.
Very mixed, yeah.
You've got the U.S. side, the EY Parthenon deal barometer people like Gregory Dacko, Mile Milosevljevic highlighting it, showing momentum building. They're forecasting deal volumes over $100 million, up like 9% into 2025. Sounds pretty optimistic.
It does. But then you look across the pond to Europe and it's a totally different story.
How so?
Kai Hesselman observed Germany is basically a buyer's market right now.
Yeah.
Valuations are lower. Sellers are under pressure. Succession issues, needing capital, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually creates opportunities for disciplined buyers.
People willing to move when others are hesitant. Anti-cyclical.
Exactly. Anti-cyclical play. So you're seeing this real divergence. Depends heavily on where you are and the local macro pressures.
Okay. So within these markets, where are we seeing specific sector activity? Any hot spots?
Energy and clean tech are definitely active. You saw Terravent Group acquiring on that wind asset, Sesenberg Futor for more second.
Mm-hmm.
Shows continued appetite for infrastructure, green assets.
It's still strong demand there.
Mm-hmm. But maybe the most disruptive signal came from tech, AI specifically.
Oh.
Yeah, this AI startup, Rogo, they just raised $50 million.
$50 million? Wow. What's Rogo doing?
They're building what they call a digital analyst, basically AI to help M&A teams and banks automate processes.
Walk with kinds of deals.
And this is key. They're focusing on the SME succession market.
Ah, interesting niche. Why is that worth $50 million?
Well, think about it. The SME market, especially succession deals, it's huge volume-wise, but often really fragmented, complex, high touch.
Right. Lots of manual work.
Exactly. So automating parts of the diligence there, like Kai Hesselman suggested Rogo is doing, tackles that complexity, makes it potentially faster, cheaper to assess those smaller deals, could be a game changer for that segment. And that idea of automating assessment leads us nicely into theme two, We've talked about where deals are happening. Now let's talk about how they're getting priced.
Okay.
And the big persistent issue, maybe even getting worse, is the valuation gap.
Right. We hear about this constantly. Jeffrey Brewster's research put some numbers on it.
Yeah. He confirmed gaps of 20 to 40% are pretty standard now in the middle market.
20 to 40%. That's massive. What's driving that?
Well, Brewster argues the core issue is buyers sticking rigidly to these standardized EBITDA multiples. You know, one size fits all.
And that misses the unique value.
Totally. It fails to capture the real differentiators. Not just, you know, good management. We're talking proprietary systems, maybe a custom-built software, really strong recurring revenue streams, mm-hmm. intangible assets that are hard to replicate.
Stuff that doesn't fit neatly into a standard formula.
Exactly. So the message for, say, CPAs advising owners, or the owners themselves, is that first fair offer based on comps. It likely leaves a huge chunk of your real value, maybe 20, 40% just sitting there.
Uh-huh.
Because you haven't properly quantified your secret sauce.
Which makes you question the models themselves, doesn't it? Lizwell Falkendorf had some thoughts on this.
She did. A really useful perspective. She said, look, DCFs, comps, precedent transactions, they're valuable tools, great for structured thinking.
Yeah.
But they're just maps.
Maps.
Yeah, yep. Maps of if-then scenarios. They're not guarantees, not promises.
Well, they need testing.
Robustly tested against reality. Mm-hmm. Like, sellers might understate maintenance CapEx to make current profits look better, right? Neglecting necessary upkeep.
Mm-hmm. Classic move.
Or the big one, terminal value dominance. For anyone listening who isn't deep in DCF's daily terminal value, is the theoretical value way out into the future, perpetuity.
And it often makes up most of the calculated value.
Often 80% or more. So if your guess about long-term growth forever is just slightly off, poof, the whole valuation can fall apart. The sensitivity is huge.
That's kind of scary. So because of all this uncertainty and these gaps, are we seeing more creative deal structures to bridge the divide?
Absolutely. People are getting really inventive to manage risk. That Lemless Clapp deal Dirk Sommer wrote about.
Okay.
Textbook example.
Okay, break that one down. What was so clever?
Well, it was a $25 million total price, mm-hmm. but look how they split it. Only $5 million was actual cash up front.
Pretty low for that size deal.
Right. Then $5 million was a vendor loan, basically, the seller financing part of the deal. Another $2 million in convertible bonds, which gives the seller potential upside later if things go well.
Okay, so spreading the risk and reward.
Exactly. But the real, the kicker was the earnout, $15 million, tied to some seriously aggressive growth targets.
$15 million. That's more than half the deal value.
Yep. Clab had to go from $2 million ARR to $10 million ARR in just 3 years. Huge pressure on performance post-acquisition.
Wow. That aligns incentives, but doesn't that kind of structure often lead to arguments later on?
It definitely can. It keeps the seller highly motivated, sure, but it also means the buyer takes on much less upfront financial risk. It's a balancing act. Financially smart, but operationally challenging, maybe.
And even when sellers think they've locked in a good price, there are other ways value leaks out, right? Adam Yohannan mentioned buy-side lawyers getting creative.
Oh, yeah. He pointed out how they strategically redefine upfront cash. They'll push hard for things like indemnification holdbacks or working capital adjustments after the headline price is agreed.
Meaning the cash the seller actually gets on day one is less than they thought.
Precisely. The seller loses leverage on that final payout amount. The actual realized cash price can end up quite a bit lower than what was initially shaken on.
So it really underscores needing sharp advisors on the structuring side, not just the valuation.
Absolutely critical to protect that final value for the seller.
Okay, let's shift gears to the third theme, execution. Strategy, integration, people. This is often where deals unravel, right? The post-closing phase.
Yeah, the stats are pretty grim. Peter Zinksecher from M&A Formula highlighted some shocking numbers.
What were they?
Something like 60 to 70% of transactions are ultimately regretted by the acquirer.
Regretted. Ouch.
And even worse, maybe up to 90% never actually create the expected shareholder value. Makes you wonder why people do M&A if the odds are that bad.
Seriously. So what separates the successes from the failures? Luck.
Not luck, according to Teeter. It hinges on M&A complementarity. But a big reason for failure, interestingly, is often poor measurement, not just bad strategy.
Measurement? How so?
Alexis Chevalier made a strong case for using economic value added EVA during post-merger integration. It's about going beyond just looking at profit.
Okay, can you give us the quick definition of EVA? What does it track?
Sure. Think of it like this. Profit just tells you if you made money. EVA tells you if you made enough money to cover the cost of all the capital you tied up to buy and run that business.
So did the deal actually earn its keep, financially speaking?
Exactly. Did the combined business truly earn its cost of capital? If the answer is no, you might show accounting profit, but you're actually destroying economic value. It's a much more rigorous way to judge real success after the deal.
That makes sense. A higher bar. Now, beyond the numbers, the human element is massive, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely critical. Paul Joyce emphasized integration leadership quality. He talked about strategic alignment, having credibility across functions, and just disciplined execution.
And he called that the pivot point.
Yeah, the absolute pivot point between value creation and, well, value destruction. If the leadership team responsible for integration isn't aligned, credible, and focused, the deal just stalls or goes sideways.
And that ties into what Dylan Roberts was saying about a people-first M&A approach.
Precisely. And he stressed this isn't just, you know, soft HR stuff. It means digging into culture and talent alignment way earlier, like during due diligence, before you close.
Because you're buying people and their ways of working, not just assets on a spreadsheet.
Exactly. Okay. You need to know if they'll fit, if key talent will stay. That has to be part of the assessment from day one.
We also need to touch on a common strategic mistake, just focusing on cost-cutting post-deal.
Right. Enter von Sen made a great point about this. He said, slashing costs only buys you time. It doesn't build long-term value on its own.
So the savings are good, but temporary.
Yeah, you get that initial cash benefit, which is nice. But the real strategic move is to take those savings and reinvest them.
Reinvest where?
Into transformation. Funding new tech implementation, maybe hiring better talent needed for the next phase, pushing into new markets aggressively. Cutting just stabilizes things. Investing is what transforms the business.
Okay, good distinction. So wrapping this theme up, let's think about founders who want a successful exit. What's the playbook?
Pramod Gosavi's advice was super clear. Absolute focus.
Focus on what?
On building a great product, building a great team, and securing a strong market position. Acquirers pay the big premiums for that powerful combination. Great product, strong brand recognition, solid team. Focus relentlessly on those three.
And start early.
Way early. Mm-hmm. Luke Patold hammered this home. M&A prep isn't a last-minute scramble. It starts 6 to 24 months before you even think about selling.
Getting your house in order, as they say.
Exactly. Mm. Clean financials, documented processes, a crystal clear story about where the value comes from. He said, if you can't nail your company's value proposition in like 90 seconds.
You lose credibility.
You lose credibility, you lose leverage, and you open yourself up to getting repriced downwards during diligence. Mm. Preparation is everything.
Okay, so this deep dive has really shown, I think, a market facing different pressures depending on why you look. U.S. optimism versus a buyer's market in Europe. We're seeing smart plays into hybrid models like that Knight experiential deal. And valuation remains tough. Pushing creativity in deal structures to bridge that gap. And maybe most importantly, the focus on non-financials using metrics like EVA, really prioritizing people and integration leadership that seems crucial for actual success.
Yeah, what really stands out is this intense demand for structure, for predictability, and what feels like a pretty chaotic market overall. Making operational readiness and human factors core to the deal thesis isn't like a nice to have anymore. It seems essential.
Right.
Which, you know, it raises a really interesting question for you, our listener, to maybe chew on. With AI tools like Rogo starting to automate deal origination and parts of diligence, how is that going to fundamentally change things next cycle? Mm. Like, will the speed AI offers start to trump the depth of traditional due diligence? What does that mean for competitive tension? Something to think about.
Definitely something to watch. If you enjoyed this deep dive, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also, check out our other editions where we focus on private equity, venture capital, and strategy and consulting. Thank you for tuning in, and make sure to subscribe for more strategic deep dives.